magic and a charisma that carries through, and you become charmed. And that was part of the whole thing. I'm sure there was a power struggle early on when Sly's charm started to take over, but he earned it. He was a DJ. He was jumping back and forth, spinning records and trying to start a band. He was doing three things at once when he was young, and he earned that. And he was really good at it. But he wrote for the times, and he wrote all the right stuff. He was getting nerves for white folks and black folks, and you know that's why we remember those songs to this day.
That's what he said.
My goodness.
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah.
You're making all that music, you're the hit of the party. Everything revolves around the good time. I mean, Sly and the Family Stone is a rolling good time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, prior to you walking in the room for this podcast, we had the pleasure of hanging out with you a couple weeks ago. And we were both profoundly affected by a number of things that you said.
Mm.
That's really why we wanted to have you back and have a microphone in front of you.
Good.
So, yeah, that, I mean, yeah, we feel like it's important.
It is.
It is. Sly, will you tell us about the first time you performed in front of a live audience?
Yeah, but it was a church song.
Okay.
It was a church song in Oakland Auditorium. And, what's the name? Brother Joe May, and, you ever heard of that? No, not Joe May. Anyway, church groups, Blind Boys, and all those people. And I went, and they put me on a table to sing. I sang, and when it was over, and people, they were happy, and I wasn't ready for that. They started coming at me, running, and getting happy out of here, and I got up and ran in the back. I got off the table and ran.
Your first live performance, you took off running.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, buddy.
Yeah, I mean, from there to Woodstock, you came a long way in a short amount of time.
I saw Sly and the Family Stone when I was 16 years old at the Spectrum in Philadelphia.
Dr. Robert Greenberg.
So this would have been 1970. The Spectrum in Philly was where the 76ers used to play. It was, you know, the big arena. And it was fantastic. And, of course, I instantly got stoned simply by breathing. We were sitting up in the balcony, and, man, forget it. No one could stay straight.
Smoke rises.
Oh, don't you know it. And it took us about 3 hours to get home that night because we didn't get to think, where are we?
Yeah.
It was a wonderful night.
Yeah.
It was just, you know, it was just fantastic.
How old were you when that happened, that first live performance?
About 9, 10, something like that.
Now, your Wikipedia biography, mm-hmm. I don't know who wrote that for you, but it says that you began playing when you were very young. What was your first instrument?
I think it was piano. I think it was piano. Drums.
Okay. So what your Wikipedia entry says was that you had mastered your first instrument when you were about 7, and then you became proficient on practically everything else on the stage when you were about 9 or 10.
Well, I would get a gig on whatever instrument. You know, I didn't know what a master was, except I would learn it well enough to get a gig. I think
master is a strong word. You know, to say that somebody has mastered something, mm-hmm. it requires a level of proficiency. Knowing this as a musician, your Wikipedia entry was probably written by somebody who's not a musician. So it's easy for them to throw words like that around. Mm-hmm. But you were good enough to get a gig when you were 7 years old. You were good enough to get a gig on several other instruments when you were 9. And so the difference, though, between a seasoned musician and somebody who's 9 years old is you get in front of an audience and they go crazy for you and you take off running.
I wasn't ready for that energy.
Right. Yeah.
So do you still play today?
Yeah.
What instruments do you grab? Like, if you're going to sit down right now and grab something, what do you play?
Well, probably a synthesizer. A lot of drums with you.
This is songwriter and record producer Preston Glass.
The great thing about Sly Stone, well, he was a big influence on me growing up when I was cutting my teeth as a songwriter. So I think his music taught me how to expand and not feel like I had to be in a box. Melodically, he stretched stuff chord-wise, you know, lyrically. He could do a message song and make it sound like it's a fun song, you know. Talk about a political situation and make it sound like it's a happy song. Sly Stone's music, to me, crosses all genres, all borders. The music that
was at heart soulful and gospely, but at the same time, very pop, very accessible, yet he was very edgy.
All right, this feels almost illegal to know, but our windows were so old and just desperately needed to be replaced. So I called a few contractors, but they all quoted me.
Because of some of the lyrics he tackled. So today, while a lot of people are complaining about quality of the music out there, you could still see his influence in some of the band, in rap music, in alternative music, in the lyrics. He was very free.
Now, can I tell a story? Because we know that you want to make music all the time. Because mm-hmm. the way that we met you mm-hmm. was we were hanging out with Corey on a Sunday night. Mm-hmm. It was Sunday night. And you called Corey and you said, Corey, I need a Mac laptop with mm-hmm. GarageBand on it. Mm-hmm. I got some ideas I got to put down right now. Mm-hmm. And it was Sunday night. Mm-hmm. Now, I know you've spent a long time as a rock star. Mm-hmm. And not a lot of people in your life tell you no mm-hmm. when it comes to, I want to make music. Everybody mm-hmm. says, well, let's get Sly making music. We want Sly to make mm-hmm. music. So that's what we did. We mobilized and we that's got cool. you a laptop with GarageBand on it. But it happened on a Sunday night. The other thing I want to say about this story was that we bought this laptop because it had GarageBand on it. And the guy who was selling it said, yeah, I use different applications and I've updated. And so I'm getting rid of this. And we said, well, do you play music? And he said, yeah, I'm a DJ. Mm-hmm. And so we said, oh, okay, great. And as we negotiated the price of the laptop, I don't know if you ever heard this. As we negotiated the price of the laptop, because the guy wanted considerably more than we paid him. Mm-hmm. But at one point, Corey had just heard, he had had enough of the negotiating, and he offered him a price. And he said, listen, take this price. He wasn't asking. He said, I'm telling you, take this price. And, you know, we had built a rapport with the guy. He was a nice guy. Corey said, take this price, and I'm going to tell you who this laptop's going to belong to when you hand it over to me. Mm-hmm. And the guy sat there for a moment, and he thought, what are you saying? And he looked over at Pete, and Pete just leaned into him and said, you should take the deal. Mm-hmm. And he looked at me, and I said, you should take the deal. And the guy looked, and we didn't say that in a threatening way, just mm-hmm. matter-of-factly, like, you will not be sorry if you take this deal. Mm-hmm. And so the guy decided, okay, I'll take the deal. That's and he good. Handed over the laptop to Corey. Mm-hmm. And Corey said, your laptop now belongs to Sly Stone. And this guy lost his mind. He lost his mind. Mm-hmm. And he was a young man.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
He was younger than we are. I mean, I would say the guy was, you know, 30 maybe.
Mm-hmm. Maybe, yeah.
And he mm-hmm. lost his mind because mm-hmm. he's a DJ. Yeah. He knows what your impact on music is.
That's good.
He went crazy.
He started physically shaking.
He did. He could not stay still. His mm-hmm. hands were shaking. He couldn't believe that his laptop, like, he just become a part of a family tree mm-hmm. that he was not prepared to become a part of.
That's good. That's good.
And then Corey picked up this part you probably mm-hmm. remember. Corey picked up the phone and called you. Mm-hmm. And said, Sly, will you talk to this individual because he's losing his mind over here? And then you talked to him for like 10 minutes. And we thought, that's nice. That's really nice of Sly, but we're trying to leave. But that's the impact you still leave behind.
That's good.
Yeah. How much do you feel that? Because it seems like you don't leave the house much. You just sit at home and make music.
I'd rather do that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You've soured of the world?
No, I'd rather play music and just rather play music.
Yeah, all day long.
Yeah.
Dave Agent.
Stan is one of the greatest albums in my life. That album is the pinnacle of Sly and the Family Stone, without a doubt. With Larry Graham's technique and Sly's arrangements, it's literally a masterpiece, rock and roll, R&B, funk, whatever you want to call it. It's just a master. I hang the progress of funk on Sly, without a doubt. If Steve Jobs put a dent in the universe, that dude put a dent in the music world. And it's still there.
I'm going to tell you another story, Sly.
Mm-hmm.
A couple years ago, mm-hmm. I was sitting at home. Corey called me. You had sent him up to Vallejo to retrieve some items out of a trailer that you had up there. And among them were a couple of guns that you were storing up there. And Corey doesn't know anything about guns, so he called me and said, "Hey, man, I need some help. I want to make sure I don't shoot myself in the foot. Can you come help me?" I said, "Sure. What do you want to do?" He said, "I got to get some stuff that belongs to Sly in this trailer over at Trailer City." And so we went over there. We went kind of organized your belongings and went through the stuff, and I made sure that Corey had packed away the guns all neatly so that he didn't shoot himself in the foot. But we went through there and did, like, we did an inventory of whatever that we could find in that were clothes and what was gear, what was usable, what didn't work anymore, whatever. Some of the stage clothes that he, well, he brought them back. So you know,
and
you saw them.
Stuff and they were stolen.
What? Wow.
Oh, I hate hearing that.
Wow. Oh, he brought back some things that we were just going, "Oh, look at this." And I mean, things that had things that you wore on stage, things that you wore on Soul Train, things that you wore that made your some crazy, shiny, crazy shit. Yeah, really.
Shiny, crazy, fluffy.
Yeah. A fur coat.
Yeah.
One thing in there was a fur coat. Another thing was a jumpsuit that had sequins all over it. And it was, and
red,
it,
black.
Yeah, yeah. And it said Sly on the back. Like, oh, man. What an awesome life it is when you get to wear this at work.
Is there a time when you met, like, Elvis and you went, "I can't believe I'm talking to Elvis"? Is there anybody that really shocked you like that?
Frank Sinatra.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So me and Billy Preston were going up to the elevator in Hawaii. And Johnny, who's, Johnny Winters was there. And he was in there already. And Johnny said, "Hey, what's up?" And I don't know why I did that, so like an asshole, but I did it. I said, "Hey, what's up?" He said, "What's up?" I said, "Edgar." That's Johnny's guy, but you know, but people laughed.
Yeah.
And we got upstairs, and there was Frank, and he was in so much awe of me that I felt weird.
Wow.
You know what I mean? He appreciated me more than I knew how to appreciate him. And I kept telling him, "Man, you're Frank Sinatra, a little bit. You Sly," but he
and he was saying, "Never mind that. Let's talk about you."
Yeah, and I got kind of weird.
Huh.
My son said, "Well,
He could have said, "Well, I'm Frank Sinatra, but I can't get away with wearing a sequin jumpsuit that says Frank on the back of it. Only you can do that."
Hey, who had the better fro, you or Billy Preston? Because yours was awesome. But Billy's, like, he could move his head and his hair would stay still.
I don't know.
Yeah. Billy's fro was, if he turned too fast, it, like, his fro would catch up a second later. You know, like, he did a move on stage, he'd go pow, and the fro would slide into place.
Hey, whose work stands out to you when you hear their music? You think, man, like, here's a story. REM has a lead singer named Michael Stipe, and he was at a U2 concert, and he's like, "I wish I would have wrote Beautiful Day. That's my song. I should have wrote that." And he says it with all the love in the world because he loves the band, but he's like, "Man, I just love that song." Do you have someone like that where you hear what they do and you're just like, "Oh, man, I wish that I could have wrote that."
Or some song that you hear and you go, "You know, if you had waited around too long, I would have ended up writing that for you."
Mm-hmm. Excuse me, Ray Charles.
Yeah.
And Beatles.
Mm-hmm. Ray Charles and the Beatles.
Yeah.
That's a pretty good company.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you ever played with Ray Charles?
Not in
a performance setting?
Right.
How was that?
It's crazy, yeah. Ray Charles was just, you know, just perfect all of it.
Yeah.
But it didn't just, it resolves everything every second. And it goes on.
Wow.
That's some heavy theory right there.
That is heavy.
Yeah.
This is Mick Gillette from the Tower of Power, and I have been a Sly Stone fan since the early days on KSOL radio. And we all used to play Frenchies and Hayward back in the late 60s. And I got to tell you, my favorite rock and roll picture of all time is hanging on my wall at home. And it's got Van Morrison sitting at a big grand piano. And sitting next to him is Bill Wyman, the Rolling Stones bass player, and he's playing an acoustic guitar. And sitting right next to him is Sly Stone playing bass. And right next to him is me playing trombone. And this is just my favorite little quartet I ever played in. Happy birthday to Sly. I hope you remember it.
Do you see your legacy when you look around at artists who are emerging now? And do you see hints of your influence in people?
Yeah, a lot of times.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, for us, it's inescapable. We look at it and we go, oh, yeah.
It's good feeling.
Yeah.
What's an example of that influence that you see?
Their style of doing music and how they act and how they're a lot of guys.
Yeah. I mean, you kind of changed just the way that a front man takes the stage. You know.
I didn't know who to copy.
Uh-huh.
So just, you know, just have to go up and do what you do.
Yeah.
And wind up whatever you do.
This is the most listened to DJ in the universe, DJ Sevier.
Wow. In my repertoire, Sly represents, to me, that soul funk with the edge of a little rebellion, but not over the top, taking it to the man, so to speak. Love City's my favorite Sly joint. I just love the beat and a lot of the message in it, but also bringing everyone together at the same time. I love what he represents as far as funk, soul, and pop. And his, the rhythm, he's definitely what I use a lot in the stadium, just because the horns, the bass line, the strings, and just growing up, just a real deep representation of being proud. And I think the one thing that I think that's just the signature Bay Area sound. And those of us in music just kind of just gravitated into it more just being that way. Like, that was pretty much the sound of the Bay, you know. And you see some of the other groups that have come around and kind of have that signature swag. A lot of people don't even know how much music actually comes from the Bay and what it represents, even down to the hip-hop. I think it kind of helps separate Northern California from Southern California. But I think it represented it so much. And to me, just basically representative of the Bay and that Bay Area sound.
Yeah. You know, one thing I love about your especially the early work with the Family Stone Band is, yeah, you were the leader and you sang a lot, but you weren't the only one that sang. That singing tool got passed around to everybody, and I can't think of another band that does that within a song. Like, the Eagles might go out and tour and it'll be Joe Walsh's song or whoever's song, but you're like, hey, I need you to sing here, I need you to sing there.
Every song was everybody's song.
Damn, it's beautiful, you know?
That's good. That's good. Well, I got some good singers.
Yeah, yeah. You did have some good singers.
One of the things that I think is really important with people like him, like Rosie, these really super hyper-duper genius musician people.
Mm-hmm.
So anyone who is a musician knows that this information, if you're writing music, this stuff doesn't come from your brain or all the hours of studying. I mean, that helps, makes it easier, the process easier, but it comes from somewhere else.
It allows you to be
a
channel.
You're a channel.
Yeah.
If you're a musician, you really are a channel. Yep. This stuff doesn't come from you.
You let your spirit speak.
And when you have someone like that, or some, you know, like Sly Stone, who is that prolific and that genius in his writing, how open is that guy to receiving all this information? He's getting so much information. It must be insane for him.
Yep. He knows
just to process that. All that information
when
that's coming to him.
Think in those terms.
I've had one experience where I got a song that came all at once. All the lyrics, the melody, all the instrumentation, all came at once. I couldn't keep up with it. It came so fast. But that guy, Prince, those kind of people, Rose, it must be a constant streaming
They see the whole picture.
Yeah.
When you try to understand Sly, like they write these stories about how he lives and his financial condition, that is not important to him. He doesn't have time to deal with that. He's got this channel.
And he needs to get it through.
That's his purpose for Sly and for all of us as music. That was what made me decide to, okay, you know, I'm going to have to do it because it's my responsibility. If I'm getting this information, then I got to get over my ego and just
allow it.
Don't give a F and put it out there.
Right.
But I do think that people get a lot of, musicians get a bad rap, especially as they get older and the money's not there anymore, right, and things start to fade out. You know, many musicians self-medicate with whatever, yes, their choice is,
yeah,
to try to deal with the monsters under their beds.
Yes. Yep.
And we all have them, and, yeah, we all deal with it as musicians. It's a thing we don't, a lot of people don't really talk about it, but it is a fact of being a musician. You do have voices in your head.
What must feel good from him, though, is he doesn't have to hide. Sly doesn't have to hide shit.
Mm-mm. And he don't want to.
He can be him 200%. Sly, yeah, is always him, and he always has been. And no matter how anyone else took it, he was still like, whatever.
And his message is so powerful
now,
and so positive.
And Sly would feel like, I'm going on the side of the stage, have a drink of water. I'll be right back. The song's still going.
Yeah.
Come back. Just, I'm going to use the restroom. And,
yeah.
And that's so real. You know what I mean? Keep it real. And they
unapologetically authentic.
Do you? Yes. Can, yeah, you think of another artist that gave up the lead singing position as much as he did?
Long as you,
because it was
it,
about, yeah, his message. Right. His message was bigger than his music.
Yeah. You know one person I think of when you say that? I think of Dwayne.
Yes. Mm. Yeah, the way they would do songs and stack it, you know what I mean? He'd say one thing, and then his sister would come in and scream, like, I'll hear now. All that. Mm-hmm. Graham come in.
That's right.
It was a family affair.
Yeah, right.
It was.
And Sly made sure it stayed that way, too.
Yep.
And you could always look at his performances like he is just, sometimes, I mean, I feel that way, too. I'm not saying I can feel like Sly, but I can understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
He just wants to do music. I'm like, what the fuck else would you want to do now?
That's,
I mean,
right,
it's like, that's all I want to do.
Everybody,
that's
in.
It. Yeah. Let the music speak.
You know? That's the most important thing to me, is that inclusiveness, and that music really does bring people together.
Yep.
So that everybody feels a part of this. And I think that's really powerful. He's so ahead of his time. Sly Stone was amazing.
Yes. And we still have him. That's dope. You see, it's in
the blood. This is Jay Moore.
Jay, when you are able to go on the road and consume the amount of music that you have consumed as a touring comedian, I get the feeling that any time that the mic and the light weren't on, you had tunes going, and you weren't just blindly consuming. Yeah, you were taking it in.
Constantly, yeah.
Like a veteran.
All day. I think standards, I think to my son.
But specifically Sly Stone, man, what do you think, what difference did he make?
Huge difference in music, because we know the hits, but then when you get deep into these albums, like Family Affair, like, yeah, everybody knows Family Affair that I just sang, but third verse, he's kind of just talking, but he's talking in a way, not talk singing like bad talk singing, you know, and guys are like, and then I went to the store and I just thought, like Red Hot Chili Peppers, but he's like, oh, let's love everybody. Oh, but he just, it's almost like this real sexy, deep drawl, but he's talking about the love of the family stone, and the family affair. Ooh, child, let's love. And it's kind of like the minimalism of what, the minimalism, the choice, the placement of the words. I don't know what the recording process was like, but nothing's wasted and nothing's superfluous.
You know, if you compare it to the really highly produced stuff of the time, let's say, I mean, even though it was elementary when it compares to some of the stuff we're doing now, but if you went for like the Temptations or, you know, a band like that, that was really, where the orchestration and the arrangement and stuff was very, very rehearsed, and then you turn the mic on Sly and he's just doing his thing and growling, and that's what's minimalist about it.
I think Sly is produced so much better because he knew when to lay off. And when you mention the Temptations, even like Otis Redding, and it's kind of overproduced. Like everybody like jacks off to Phil Spector and the Wall of Sound. It's like, bro, it's Be My Little Baby. What Wall of Sound?
Yeah.
Like nobody listens to Be My Little Baby and goes, holy shit, listen to that best. No, when you listen to the James Gang and realize it's only three guys, you go, what the fuck? That's a Wall of Sound,
that's,
man.
A wall
Nirvana.
Of sound.
That's a Wall of Sound.
When Mick Gillette blows his horn, that's a Wall of Sound.
Pete, can we ever have a conversation without you? We know, Pete, you're a top. We're bottoms. We got it, buddy.
Hey, man.
Oh, hold on. I got Cindy Crawford calling me again. I gotta go.
All right. How in shape are you to play live?
When rehearsing is what I want to do.
Yeah.
Get the rehearsing done. And right. Then it's no job.
Okay. So you're not going to present it before it's time.
Well, I don't like to jam too much because I get, it blows my head into my head. It feels like I got to do better than everybody, and that's not what the thing is about.
Still? You still feel that way?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a competitive streak that a young musician would feel, but you still have that?
Yeah, I want to just do it better than everything. And that's not a good thing, maybe, but it's rehearsing,
Yeah.
You do it all day, and you got a certain feeling about a song, and you know what it is, right? And you get something that means a lot. It's a hint. It's something to make you lean over and hit a chord. You have to do that.
Right.
When you're rehearsing, and to that extent, that's what you do. That's what I like to do with a lot of people. The people I'll get to where they, man, that brother was crazy. But but that's what it is.
You are crazy a little bit.
Yeah.
That's all right, though.
Yeah. It's been many, many years, I think, that you've cultivated this sense. And you don't think with what you created at a young age and the stuff that you were able to say, here's my stamp on the world. Now what you going to do with it?
That's all I know is what I do.
Yeah. Wow. So tell us some wacky stories about people from throughout time that are remarkable or that you think, or that amused you or whatever. Drop some wisdom on us.
I don't know stories right now. but I tell you what.
I heard Miles Davis pulled a gun on you.
He pulled a gun in the
Is
pulled
that true?
Everybody in the room.
He pulled a gun on everybody in the room.
Yeah, I told him, pull that shit down, man. I know he's funny. He's got to be telling jokes.
That was Miles being funny? He pulled a gun on everybody in the room?
Yeah, he came in with the gun. I said, put that shit down, man. You can't do that. He put it down.
Okay. You probably had a tone in your voice like, man, I'm from Vallejo. I got a .32 in my pocket. No, you better put that down.
But I didn't feel any
animosity. Yeah.
But he had a gun, so everybody was a little wacky. No, you can't do that, Miles. Don't do that.
At his house? At a party? No. What makes you...
At a place like a little studio at 25 Central Park West. Yeah.
25 Central Park West. Yeah. Wow. Okay. I guess, man, what do you do with that? I mean, that's Miles Davis. And you go, hey, man, you're armed and dangerous.
Yeah. You live in and lived in a rock star world where people did have different rules and everything. Among those guys, who really stands out as being just over the top? You're like, man, I hope Bob doesn't come over because that guy is crazy.
So hey, Charles Manson.
No shit. All right, tell us about that.
No, he needed to get out of there. I didn't know he was. I didn't know that he was leaving. I didn't know Doris wanted to get out, but she still sort of winding down.
Well, hold on. Wait a minute. You jumped ahead of us here. What? You talking about Charles Manson?
Mm-hmm.
He hung out with a lot of musicians.
Yeah.
So what was going on there?
I just realized that he had to get out of the house because Doris, that's what I felt about Doris Day. She's just a nice lady, that's all.
Yeah.
So I thought maybe you ought to get out, sir. That's right. So I got in and I started encouraging him to get out.
How do you encourage
Charles?
You
have a way of mildly encouraging people to do something.
Well, if they gotta go.
Uh huh. So you mildly encouraged Charles Manson to exit the premises and he left.
Yeah, he got out.
And then he became Charles Manson in somebody else's house.
Yeah.
What was he doing there?
Getting people, you could tell he was crazy.
Yeah, and he was trying to pull people into his...
He was doing it. I could see him doing it.
Yeah. Back then, when, musical styles were kind of melting together, who do you think was responsible for really mixing styles more than anybody else? Who was the more adventurous of the musicians that you knew around then?
You should think about...
Who did you admire for their sense of creativity?
Kind of hard to say, man. Everybody was in a category.
Yeah.
And they stayed there.
What allowed you to break those categories, though? Because you weren't beholden to the categories. You kind of did what you wanted to do.
Because that's just the way I saw it. You know?
Yeah.
I just know if I got a good record, and if he's a country listener, then it will be that. I know it will be that.
Yeah.
Just, that's the way it is.
And your record company trusted you.
They had to.
You were going to give them what you were going to give them. Hey,
yeah, honest to God, yeah.
That's wow.
We were rehearsing for that, for the good reasons, and everybody's into it. They got to like it.
You can't do that anymore.
No. Yeah, you can.
You think so?
Yeah.
You just think people aren't doing it as much as they should be.
Yeah, people just don't have the stupidity or the courage or whatever it takes to say what you got to say and do it with no harm in it.
Yeah.
But this is it.
Not everybody has that much to say, Sly.
I believe that.
Not everybody has that much to say. Did you know Levon Helm?
I've heard the name.
Oh, okay. I thought maybe you knew him because I love him. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was a big, big fan, and he was just seemed to be the same kind of free spirit that you were. And I was curious to know if you guys crossed paths, but it seems like you guys didn't cross paths. Did the band play Woodstock?
The band played at Woodstock.
I mean, there was several days between you guys, probably.
Is there a song that you've written that you thought, this is a great song, and it's going to be a hit, and it just absolutely is not a hit? Is there a song like that there for you?
Oh, yeah. Underdog. Yeah, it's just a funky song, but I could find out what was wrong. I got Dave Kaplan, and he told me it's kind of just the beat and the words. It's got to be a melody. It's got to punish the song, and that's what it's got to be only. And that's why I took it. So I wrote Dance to the Music.
Okay.
Like, it's a formula that's easy to do. Like, you just add some sugar and you put in a little bit of...
Kind of like that, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How many songs do you think you've got in the catalog now that you're waiting to release? 100.
I don't know. I don't even know.
Yeah.
You have a notebook right in front of you.
Yeah, because I was working on a song.
Yeah. You are always, regardless of what else is going on, always working on a song.
Well, I like to be ready, you know.
And you talked about someone just right then who was an influence on how to write songs.
Who was it? Can you say the name again? I didn't catch it.
Dave Kaplick.
Dave Kaplick.
My first manager.
Okay.
Okay.
The first and the last.
What happened to him?
He got tired of it. He got money and go to Hawaii.
He got money and took off to Hawaii. Yeah, that was it for that.
He's cool as far as I know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, good for him.
Yeah.
Yeah. But he sort of left you in a position where you are now, where you have to fight over stuff.
You're right. But I believe me.